practical web accessibility tips. Welcome to WebX, episode 33, interview with Patrick Lauk. This is your host, Dennis.
And I'm your co-host, Ross.
How you doing today, Ross?
Not too bad. How about you?
Pretty good. We got a couple of news and another announcement to make. Computer Weekly magazine published an article about accessibility.
Yeah, I came across this and thought that it was pretty cool that a magazine was publishing information about accessibility and kind of getting it to the mainstream.
Yeah, it was a good article. And it's not very technical, you know. It's geared more towards the general audience and business owners, which I thought was great to get the word out.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of business owners don't know much about accessibility, if anything at all.
Right. The other news item is the National Center for Accessible Media, NCAM, out of Boston, Massachusetts, USA, has released a set of accessibility guidelines, and which I thought were very good and worth a mention. It's called Accessible Digital Media, Design Guidelines for Electronic Publications, Multimedia, and the Web.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to look over them yet, but I definitely plan to, because anything that kind of guides us on what we should look at to make sure things are accessible and everybody can access the information is beneficial.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, in the perfect world, I think, you know, one set of perfect guidelines that everyone in the world can go to would be wonderful, but, you know, this is not a perfect world. So we have another set of guidelines, but I think are, like I said, are very good and worth taking a look at.
Yeah, so, it's definitely work in the right direction as far as guidelines and constructing something that we can kind of put together to use as a whole.
Right. We have one other announcement. We held a Refresh Detroit meeting last Wednesday.
Yep, that was great. The group is definitely growing, and we got some developers who work on the state of Michigan websites to show off, which was great.
Yeah, that was real cool. And we'll be meeting again in Brighton, Michigan next month, November 29th, at Stout Pub. And so if anyone in the area is interested, you know, you're welcome to join us. And for more information, go to refresh-detroit.org and check it out.
Yep, we'll be having a short presentation on information architecture, so that should be worth coming by and listening to.
Definitely. Okay, well, that's enough for the announcements, and let's get on to our main feature. We have Patrick on the line.
Hello.
Patrick is a well-known resource in the web community. He has been the webmaster at the University of Salford since January of 2001. Yeah, is that correct?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Okay, and he's heavily involved in WASP, Web Standards Project, the Accessibility Task Force.
Yep.
And is co-author of a new book, Web Accessibility. So how are you doing this Sunday, Patrick?
Oh, I'm doing great, yeah. It's doing this podcast is a good excuse to get out of the usual cleaning chores, so I've got a good excuse to lock myself in my room for a bit.
There you go. Let's see. I guess our first question is, how did you originally get into web design?
Oh, right. Let's see. Back in, it must have been about 1996. I started doing a computer science course at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich. And I started getting involved in all the, you know, programming side of things, etc. But it kind of soon became apparent that I wasn't really cut out that much to do the hardcore kind of computer science stuff, you know, analysing algorithms and everything else. But what I did get out of my stint there at the Swiss Federal Institute was they had loads of open access PCs with access to the internet, and at that point in time, I hadn't really experienced anything in terms of internet, so that was my first kind of exposure to the web as it was back then, back in 96. So it was quite interesting. I kind of started looking up the kind of fledgling first kind of corporate sites, you know, things like MTV.com and everything else. Started getting very interested in, you know, the potential at the time of getting all this access to information, you know, readily available. And I also started kind of dabbling with actually learning how to create web pages, what's involved behind the scenes, looking at HTML, starting to learn HTML pretty much from scratch by just following examples. Back then, there weren't any major resources yet, as far as I was aware, on, you know, doing web design and everything else. So there was a lot of learning by doing, looking at, you know, back in the days when we had like Netscape 4.7 was the default browser there on the computer. So I do, like, you know, look at the source code, try to do my own little things with HTML. Stumbled across the, back then already, stumbled across the actual W3C site with the specification, and trying to learn HTML from basic principles, really. And things like Java started kind of appearing around about that time as well.
And is this about the time you were, because I believe you have a bachelor's degree in like a graphic arts. Is this about the time you were doing that?
That was before then. That was I've had a very kind of checkered past, I have to say. Maybe to kind of backtrack a bit, I'm originally German, but I grew up in Italy and then went to school in Switzerland before ending up over here in the UK.
Oh, wow.
So that was, yeah, that was the time when I was still kind of trying to find my way in the world, and I thought at the time that computer science was the thing to do. Later on I found out that I was wrong, but as I said, you know, back in 96, the good thing is I started doing web stuff. So, as I said, I started learning HTML, trying to do my own little web page. We had some web space there available for all the computer science people, had their little account where they could put like 20k or something of stuff on there, so you put a few images up and, you know, try to create a cool web page or something.
Right. Now you have a master's degree in technology as well as your BA. Can you describe how, you know, your education in both design and technology have helped you in web design?
Yeah, as I said, you already mentioned that I've got a BA in graphic design. That really came about because, as I said, I wasn't quite happy with the computer science stuff. I was interested in you know, programming and everything, but not to the kind of hardcore extent that they were doing. I switched over to graphic design, and I came over to the UK. So I did pretty much, very much print-based kind of graphic design. And then, kind of to round it off, I did this master's, as you mentioned, in creative technology, which was, I suppose, the kind of way to bring the two together, really. A lot of the people on my course there on the master's course were doing a lot of installation art and, you know, using sensors and triggering video and things like that. But for my part, I started going more into, you know, using the web and putting my kind of graphic skills to good use. And I think that kind of brought my two interests together. As I said, even now I've still got an interest in programming. But as I said, not to the kind of analysing algorithms and things like that kind of extent. I do like programming from a point of view of, you know, it's a way of achieving something. But at the same time, I've also got a certain kind of visual flair, a kind of a design flair. And this master's course kind of helped me bring it together. And more generally, I think that what you traditionally see still at this point in web design is, more often than not, you've got a very cut and dry split between graphic designers, often traditionally from a print design background, that are kind of dabbling with the web. They don't really understand it. They just see it as a delivery medium for their stuff. So,
right.
You know, they do things in Photoshop or whatever, chop it up, save it as GIFs, put it up on a ready-made kind of web page, you know, generates the markup, and they think they're doing web design. And also on the other end of the spectrum, you often get people that are really, really good kind of programmers, kind of back-end developers, that are doing, you know, fantastic stuff in terms of aggregating content and mashing things up and everything else, but they just, you know, you couldn't even tell them, you know, choose two colours that go well together, because they just don't have that flair. So they do something that works really well from the technology point of view, but really looks very horrid kind of stuff. So, you know, it's often a kind of a very pigeonholed kind of, you're either one or the other. Although in recent years, I'm kind of beginning to see that there is a new breed of web designers who've got a little bit of both skills, and I really think that at this stage anyway, when you're doing a lot of projects on your own, unless you're in a big team where you've got very clearly defined roles of those, you know, you've got your back-end developer and then you've got your front-end developer and somebody doing the middleware and whatever, but if you're doing if you're a one-man band kind of thing doing web, you really need to have some kind of at least a little bit of understanding of both disciplines. It's not enough to say, I just do design, I don't care about the markup, or I'm just the back-end developer, I don't care about you know, what the output is at the end of the day in terms of what the HTML is and how it looks. You need to really kind of multi-skill on that level. And there are a lot of kind of the new breed of designers that are coming along, you know, people like Andy Clark from Stuff and Nonsense, you know. He's kind of the epitome of that kind of new breed, I would say. You know, he's a cracking designer. He's also got a great understanding of, you know, the markup and the CSS and what's involved. And because a lot of the tools that are out there at the moment for web development, they're still very much they're user friendly to a certain extent. But if you really want to take advantage of, you know, web standards and everything else, you really need to get your hands dirty and kind of start doing your code by hand. So at this stage, you need that kind of, the two kind of interests. You need to have both a very analytical kind of programming mind to do the, you know, the HTML and working out the best way to semantically structure something, and doing the CSS, because the CSS stuff is still very much propeller head kind of stuff. If you're going beyond the basics, working around browser bugs and everything else as well. But at the same time, you need you should really have some kind of understanding of you know, what looks good, all the related fields like usability as well and everything mm-hmm. else. So I think that my kind of strange background in terms of starting off with the very dry, very, very kind of boring, from my point of view, programming side, and then moving over to graphic design and then bringing the two together, kind of has helped me, because I wouldn't say I'm a excellent designer, I wouldn't say I'm a, you know, perfect coder, but I think I bring enough of both disciplines that at the very least I can kind of converse with both camps. And working in a team, for instance, I've had it on a few occasions, working on a kind of team of 2-3 people, I usually end up being the kind of facilitator that can talk to both the techies and the designers and kind of bring them together, you know, to a kind of a common ground.
So what sparked your interest in web accessibility?
Right. After my master's course, I started obviously looking for a job. I had a few bills to pay at that point, and I kind of noticed that there was a job advert at the university where I just finished my master's course for a web editor. So that was back in, as you say, back in January 2001, pretty much. I started there. Mm-hmm. And as part of the job, really, in the job spec itself, it mentioned that the candidate should have at least an understanding of web accessibility. And as you do when you're kind of preparing for an interview, you think, oh, I've never heard of that. I'll quickly read up on it so I can at least blag my way through the interview. As you do, you know. So as I started that, you know, I had a quick look. Up until that point, I think I might have vaguely heard about web accessibility, but, you know, it wasn't the cool thing to do, especially, you know, doing more of my graphic design kind of stuff. I didn't really care about it, or I didn't really know enough about it to care, mm-hmm. shall we say. But, you know, I started for the interview, I started looking into it and got a little bit of an understanding, and it obviously was enough to get me the job, so that was good. But as I then kind of started with the job itself, I started kind of looking deeper into it and taking it seriously because it was a requirement of the job. And I started getting involved in discussions and conversations with my peers, really, working at other universities. And there are kind of various groups in the UK kind of higher education and further education market who are like associations of web editors and web people across the various universities. And there's a very, very kind of a load of camaraderie going on, a load of sharing good practice and everything else, which was quite refreshing at the time. There's not much of a competitive angle there. So we started kind of sharing experiences and sharing kind of our understanding of web accessibility as part of our kind of shared duty in terms of running university websites, because you know, universities traditionally have had a much stronger kind of corporate responsibility, I would say, in terms of, you know, realizing that they need to actually provide this sort of stuff.
Oh, definitely.
So not purely from a web point of view, but also, you know, just recently, a few years ago, a lot of the universities had to do a lot of changes to their physical environment to make sure that, you know, access ramps are put in place, etc. So from an organisational point of view, it was quite a good one to kind of work in, because they do realise their responsibility. So what I found at the time when I started getting involved with all these discussions with my peers, really, is that there was a lot of, well, everybody knew that web accessibility is something we need to do and we need to start thinking about. But there was a lot of, beyond the basic kind of everybody pointing at the WCAG document, but beyond that, beyond the very basics of, yeah, we need alt text if we put images in, there was still a lot of uncertainty, and there probably still is, a lot of uncertainty about what to do with the more complex kind of scenarios and how to go about, you know, what does it mean when you say we need an alternative? What is an alternative? You know, is there a cut and dry rule, or is it up to the individual? Can it change depending on context, etc.? So I found that there was a lot of uncertainty and a lot of people just stumbling around trying to actually understand, make out exactly what they're supposed to do beyond the basics of, well, this is the WCAG document, follow that. But it doesn't make sense. Well, don't care, just follow the rule, you know, make it up yourself. So a lot of the discussions really started crystallizing into, well, I'm doing this, do you think this is good practice? So I found that it was quite interesting from my point of view, because it was almost a bit like it's kind of the frontier land kind of scenario of there's a lot of opportunities there to contribute in a kind of meaningful way, because there weren't any ready-made kind of solutions. There was nobody that could say, right, you know, you need to do exactly this, because it all depends on, you know, a variety of factors. There was still a lot of scope for, you know, working with it, coming up with a solution that maybe other people will find interesting, and basically just carry on with the discourse, and at the end of the day, doing it for a good cause and trying to find good solutions to problems that a lot of people have, and that if you manage to solve them, that you make the web, you know, that you can make the web a better place for certain types of people. So that's what kind of sparked my interest, really, in it, for some reason. I kind of started sliding into this, mm-hmm. and getting quite passionate and quite vocal about it.
And now you're a team member now of Accessify.com.
Yep.
Can you tell us how, like, you got into that, and you know, what it's all about, or what your plans are for the future?
Yeah, sure. I had a think, because when you sent me your initial rough questions, I knew that you were going to ask me about Accessify, and I had to cast my mind back and try to remember, how did I get into Accessify.com? I've got no idea. I think it's probably around the time, probably 2002, 2003, I was heavily kind of active on the SitePoint forums. At the time, I kind of ended up becoming a moderator, and later on even an advisor, which is kind of one level up on the SitePoint forums. And flying the flag, really, for accessibility and everything else. At the time, there wasn't really a sub-forum or anything specifically for accessibility, so I was kind of trawling the general web design kind of sections, and also a little bit of the PHP kind of forum itself, because I started doing a lot of PHP at the time, but mainly in the web design bit, there were a lot of questions every now and again about accessibility. So I started getting heavily into that in terms of spending every day at least 2-3 hours spread out throughout the day, being on the SitePoint forums, answering questions, trying to work out, you know, are there other people on the forum that kind of share my interests and everything else. And I guess, I'm not sure, but I guess that Ian Lloyd, who's the chap that actually started Accessify.com, I think he was, he'd already written, I think, a few articles for SitePoint at that point in time. I do remember that there was an article about accessible forms, which I think was one of the first ones that I came across on such a kind of major general interest kind of site. As I said, I'm guessing that I must have kind of got in touch with him back then through the forum when he started Accessify, and became kind of a part of the initial kind of contributor team that you know flagged up articles and wrote little bits of information, pointed out other pieces of info that might have been around at the time. Probably the relationship there developed. I mean, Ian and I are now great friends, and whenever we kind of bump into each other at conferences, it's always the beer flows quite freely at that point. But Ian went off for a year. He kind of took a sabbatical for a year from his job at Nationwide, one of the big banks here in the UK, where he did a lot of work already on accessibility. So he took a year out to travel the world, and he went, you know, to Australia, Thailand, all over the place, really, with his, I think she was fiancée at that point. She wasn't his wife yet, but his girl, let's say. And at that point, he basically asked me if I could kind of mind the shop for him while he was out, effectively. So I effectively took charge of the Accessify.com. I kind of babysat it while he was traveling the world and being in places where often you would have like a 28k modem at best. So he did say, no, I can't run this site while I'm on the road. Would you mind just looking after it, making sure it ticks over? And I got heavily into, I went through a phase of posting, 3-4 stories a day, really, on Accessify, and making sure that things are running smoothly. When he came back, he then switched service providers, so we went from ASP to PHP, and I helped out with that aspect of, recoding some of the tools that he had and everything else. And I've been kind of, active behind the scenes on Accessify ever since. In recent, probably in the last year or so, I've kind of had to scale my direct involvement down a little bit. So I go in phases. Sometimes I post like 3-4 news stories, and then I might go for months not actually posting anything. But I'm still there. I'm still behind the scenes. I think that pretty much is the story of Accessify as well.
Yeah, the tools and wizards on Accessify.com are really cool. So anybody listening, if about web standards and accessibility, then you really appreciate what some of those tools and wizards can do because they make it easier for just some common tasks.
Yeah, that can be pretty helpful.
Yeah, they take the initial fear away from, how do I do an accessible form or an accessible table? So I find them excellent, yeah.
Yeah, I use them myself quite a bit. So you also freelance? And you have your site, splinter.com. Do you want to talk a little bit about your freelance projects and things you've done with that?
Splinter.co.uk. I haven't managed to get the .com yet, although I'm waiting until that one frees up. I do the occasional bit of freelance. I'm in the very lucky situation that my day job, although it doesn't pay that fantastically, it does keep me afloat quite nicely. I managed to pay the bills on time and pay the mortgage and everything else. So I'm probably in the very enviable position that when I do freelance, I can pick and choose which projects I really want to do. And often it's projects that I've got personal interest in, something that somebody says, I'm thinking of doing this, and I can say, oh yeah, cool, I'll help out. I often do a my middle name should be pro bono, because I do a lot of stuff for friends and associates and families and everything else. I'm quite lucky in that respect, that I don't have to choose jobs because I know that I have to pay the bills, and I can turn jobs down. You know, the nightmare jobs that you hear about on mailing lists, where they say, how can I convince my client that an all-flash site is really a disingenuous kind of idea?
Yeah, so really.
I'm in the lucky position that I can, you know, right from the start, I can say, look, you know, no offence, but I don't really have the time to do that at the moment. I can point them to other people and say, that I've got a little network of friends that do freelance as well. I can point them in that direction, but I don't have to slog through projects that I just hate. So that's quite good.
You can point them to us if you want, Pat.
We'll get a little, after this we'll get a little commission basis.
Yeah,
sounds good.
We'll haggle on the percent price, yeah. So yeah, I do the occasional bit of freelance, but it's not my main drive. I mean, my main interest is, because the monetary side of things is sorted, I've got more time to just do little experiments and things on my website, and that's really where my passion lies. So I often see the kind of freelance work that I do as secondary. The primary role of my site is really, if I've got some kind of crazy idea, some kind of, I've been doing a few Firefox extensions, etc. I like to post them there and say, hey, you know, this might spark some conversation, this might be a good idea, and just get something out there. It's really a kind of a playground for crazy ideas that I've got in terms of, you know, CSS and crazy uses of
I've seen your experiments. You got a frugal Google.
Yeah, just recoding the Google website, basically the Firefox Google kind of homepage thing, and actually using kind of web standards, because what's currently there, the kind of default Google Firefox page, is just horrid kind of table-based markup. So yeah, little experiments, little things in terms of, you know, often web standards. And I used to do a little bit of Flash years ago, so I've got a few experiments in Flash back in the archives. Just trying to have fun, really. That's my main purpose with these things, is having fun. If
right.
Something good comes out of it, share it with the rest of the world. It might not be fantastic, but it might spark greater minds to kind of follow those lines of inquiry and kind of come up with something good.
Yep.
And going back to...
Go ahead.
Going back to accessify.com, are they a part of accesssites.com?
No, that's two separate kind of initiatives. Access Sites, that's a guy called Mike Cherim, or Sherim, I'm not quite sure about that.
Were you involved with that?
I was at one point. It was, I think that was just before Christmas last year. Mike was kind of, he's already been active on the Accessify forums, which, as I'll do a little plug here as well for.
Sure.
Even though it's part of the kind of Accessify site itself, it's actually a separate project run by a chap called Nigel Peck, who's got a web design consultancy in, Sheffield. He set up the forum a few years after Accessify started, and that's another great resource for, you know, just sharing your thoughts on accessibility and, you know, chatting to like-minded individuals on accessibility. That's another one where I started off as a simple kind of a mere mortal kind of poster, and then I managed to wangle my way into becoming a moderator. And often Nigel was away again on business, and I again kind of ended up minding the shop for him. So a good resource, you know, if you want to have a good chat about accessibility with kind of slightly hardline but quite likeable individuals like myself, that's a good place to be. But I think this guy Mike, if I remember, Mike Cherim, he was part of this group of people that are kind of chatting online, and I knew him from various kind of mailing lists. And just before Christmas last year, he decided to set up this site, this Access Sites website, which essentially offers kind of free, completely free kind of site accessibility testing. And they give out little awards and everything else for, you know, best site, best accessible site, etc. It's kind of a grassroots accessibility testing and kind of showcase site. And I was involved in the very early stages. Mike was gathering a lot of the great and the good of accessibility to help out as testers, basically, for these awards that they were giving out. Now, unfortunately, in the end, it turned out that I didn't have enough time to actually really devote myself to access sites, because I ended up with, at that point, a lot of freelance work, strangely enough, and a lot of stuff during my day job really kept me from getting really involved. So I kind of stepped back from that one, because I thought, if I can't devote myself to it properly, then there's no point in having like my name under the team and everything else. We need to get the team down. But I still provide them with they've got kind of an internal mailing list that they run, so I still provide them with the actual mailing list platform, so they can use that to communicate. And I think I still link to them, and yeah, they're doing a great job. There's a lot of really, really good, technically good, and also, as people, good people there that help out. People are good friends of mine, like Andy Saxton, etc. Kind of some of them slightly lesser known people, but nonetheless, very, very knowledgeable and very, very good in terms of wanting to do the right thing. And and also my old nemesis, Tommy Olsen, works there as a tester. Well, I say nemesis, we have a few disagreements, so it's a bit of banter going on. He's very hardline in ways that I'm not hardline, but so we've had a few disagreements in the past. But no, it's a good bunch of people, and they're doing quite a good thing, and certainly helping the general cause of accessibility by just devoting a lot of their free time to these kind of things, because it does take a lot of time to give a good kind of accessibility test to a site and really run it through its paces and say, these are the things that need tweaking, etc. So, hats off to the guys for really kind of doing it out of the goodness of their heart.
Yeah, it's a neat site. They have a lot of good resources listed. They have an interesting checklist on how they grade and evaluate sites, and they're doing a great job. And they must be doing a great job, because my company, CheckEngineUSA.com, actually received an award from them a couple months ago. So yeah, so that was pretty neat. And
their testing parameters, I think they strike a good balance between, they're not just ticking the WCAG boxes, but they're very, which is kind of a thing that I'm keen on. They're very pragmatic in many ways, they're more real world than basically just saying we ran your site through Bobby and did a few manual checks. So I think they strike a really good balance with those kind of real world checklists. So yeah, great job,
Ross.
As far as the Web Standards Project, which you're a part of. Mm-hmm. And that can be found at webstandards.org. It states that the Accessibility Task Force works with accessibility organization, technology vendors, excuse me, and others to help promote web accessibility. Can you give us a couple examples of what you do specifically?
Yeah, the WASP ATF, as we like to call it, that's been formed, I think, after AppMedia 2005, that was, in the kind of the drink session after AppMedia. We were talking to people like, Molly Holtzschlag was there. Obviously, she's the Web Standards Threadborg main lead at the moment. We started talking about accessibility in general, and really the group itself came out of, was born out of the frustration that a lot of us have in terms of, here we are trying to do a lot of good stuff with web standards, but at the same time, browsers, screen readers, like assistive technology in general, are still very much in the dark when it comes to web standards. A lot of the screen readers, although it's got better in the last year or so, a lot of screen readers still don't really care about web standards. They don't really understand web standards, and you can't blame them to a certain extent, because they might take the attitude of, 90% of the web is still tag soup and everything else. So why should we honour web standards when nobody else does? But there was this frustration of, here we are, we're talking about We're having really heated debates about what is the most semantic way of marking this up and marking that up, when at the end of the day, a lot of the assistive technology doesn't even care about it or doesn't even understand it. They'd much rather use heuristics and treat all your content as kind of tag soup anyway, and then try to work it out for themselves rather than look at the markup. Because with the markup, there's a lot of stuff in HTML even where you can define very clear, unequivocal relationships between pieces of information in a page, for instance. But a lot of AT and a lot of browsers and screen readers, etc., aren't taking advantage of it. Although, as I said, it's slowly coming around and becoming better. On the other hand, you've also got content management systems, blog software, authoring tools in general that are still kind of, a lot of them are still very much ignoring web standards. Again, this is slowly changing, but there's still a lot out there, particularly when we start talking about, you know, the big iron kind of CMSs like Overture and things like that. Overture, am I thinking right? Yeah, one of them. They still, you know, they don't produce valid markup and they're not accessible. They don't care about accessibility. Their output is not accessible, and their actual, you know, interface behind the scenes isn't accessible. So there's a lot of and there's a lot of snake oil salesmen out there that try to sell you the perfect magic bullet kind of solution. They say, oh, you don't, as a site owner, you don't have to worry about accessibility. Just buy our product, the text transcoder, and we create a text-only version from your site that's accessible. You don't have to worry about it. So all of these kind of things really brought out the frustration in us, and to try to do something about it. As I said, we did set up the ATF. Now, although we've been, we formed about a year and a bit ago, we're still in the very early stages to kind of forge relationships with these various browser developers, screen reader manufacturers, etc. But so we're still doing a lot of groundwork, but we're aiming to work along the same lines as the Web Standards Microsoft Task Force, who've done a great job of just meeting and just kind of chatting with not to belittle their work, they obviously did a lot more, but you know, in general, in basic terms, they've had a good conversations all the time with Chris Wilson and Cole from the Microsoft's IE team, and really kind of get into a discourse with the actual browser developers and to make them understand, you know, this is why we care about web standards. This is where your products still need to kind of fill the gap, really. They're still not compliant in certain aspects here. They're not taking advantage of this. So we're aiming to work along those lines, and what we've done recently is we've drafted a full-on manifesto on the which you can find on the webstandards.org site, all about what we're aiming to do, what the current situation is, explaining all of this about, we do web standards, some of these tools still don't take advantage of it when they really should. And we've been giving out the manifesto and an open letter, a call to action to kind of browser developers, etc., that we're here to help if you want to engage in a discourse with us. And we've already started kind of giving these out in printed form and email form to a variety of kind of developers, people at Freedom Scientific who make JAWS, various kind of smaller screen reader developers. I mean, I'm hoping to soon tackle this. There's a very well-known one here in the UK called Dolphin, who create a product called How, which is one of the screen readers here. We're trying to basically, as I said, just initially forge some links with these people. We've got task force members who are more directly involved already. We've got James Craig, who's a member of the task force, who is now working at Apple, and he's forging contacts with, you know, the Safari team and the voiceover teams within Apple. Also, myself and a good friend of mine, task forcer as well, Bruce Lawson, we've been in direct contact with people at Opera. We got a really good contact there in Opera, who they're really keen on accessibility, and Yahoo as well. I've got a few people. We know a few people at Yahoo UK. Also got contacts with people in Yahoo over in the States. and really kind of trying to, as at this stage, get a discourse going, get some engagement, get some discussions going. We're getting ready to release. We've kind of jotted together a little wish list within the task force, a little wish list of things that where we think browsers aren't really following the spirit of the user agent accessibility guidelines, where you hear a lot about the WCAG, the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, but there's another set of guidelines that's aimed specifically at user agent developers in terms of your products need to make it easy for people to just navigate content by a keyboard, etc. There's a lot of things that browser developers, for instance, mainly seem to follow the letter of UAG, the User Agent Accessibility Guidelines, but not the spirit. There are a lot of things where, for instance, keyboard access still isn't 100%, where, for instance, if you have title information on a link or something like that, you only get that information usually if you hover over with a mouse. If you go via the keyboard, there's no way that you can access the title information. And that's just, you know, that's just the most, that seems to us anyway, the most basic kind of requirement. If it says you might be a sighted user, so it's not an issue purely of the screen reader should deal with it, but say you just haven't got the use of your hands and you're just using the keyboard to navigate, you can see the screen perfectly well, why isn't a tooltip coming up on a link that has got a title when you navigate with a keyboard? Why is it purely with a mouse? I mean, that's such an obvious kind of example where the browser developers just don't follow the general kind of user agent accessibility guidelines. So we've kind of, that was one of the many kind of points that we've put together. We're still finalising it. It's taking a little while because we are a large group and it's often difficult to get full-on consensus. But Bruce Lawson and I mainly are kind of trying to push that through, and we've already sent this list to our contacts at Opera and Yahoo, and they were quite interested. Opera, from a browser implementation, native implementation point of view, but we were chatting with people at Yahoo in terms of if the browsers don't do it quickly enough, maybe we can bridge the gap with the things like the Yahoo toolbar, for instance. It could offer additional kind of hooks for people who need it. So the response on that one has been really, really positive, I have to say. You know, a lot of people that are very willing to listen at these places. So, as I said, to sum this whole rant up a bit, it's we're still at the early stages, even though we've been formed for a year and a bit, but we're slowly making progress, I would think.
That's great. That sounds like you're filling a big void as far as connecting all these technologies and developers and the community together.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
We're trying to, anyway.
As a member of the community, like, what can we do to help with the WASP ATF task force? I saw on the site you guys recommend reporting, like, browser bugs to help promote standards.
Yeah.
I guess the same would go with like screen readers and things like that. If users could report any kind of bugs or issues with web standards.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think a lot of users really need to start being more vocal about things. Without going too much into this, because it's my kind of hobby horse argument, there's a lot of pressure always on web content developers and web designers to make up for the problems that user agents have. The classic one of Internet Explorer doesn't resize pixel-based fonts, so you need to use M's or something. You know, that is the right thing to do in that particular scenario, but I've seen more and more there's things like users don't know that they can resize their text, so you as a web content developer need to put a widget on the page that says, text plus, text minus. Or things like users don't know that they've got a print preview option, so or that they can print, so you must provide, or you should really provide a link to print a friendly page, or print preview and everything else, which in my mind that kind of crosses the line a bit between what are we web content developers, or should we, is it our responsibility to patch up shoddy implementation in browsers and also the fact that users are, you know, to a certain extent, they're not educated enough to know that they can resize text. Is it our responsibility to kind of patch these things up? So, sorry, I've kind of went off on a tangent here. But yeah, so if users, yeah, that would happen very often. Now, if users find that they can't do something on a web page, it's quite often, you know, the fault of the browser for not giving them that particular option. So I would welcome it if users who are in the know could then start complaining, and more of a grassroots kind of movement from the user's point of view, saying, demanding better products from you know, browser developers, rather than instantly jumping on the web content developers and designers saying, you know, you need to provide us with a widget on your page to do text resizing. I mean, just on that text resizing issue, I mentioned before my experiments. One of my experiments is a little extension for Firefox that simply puts the text resize options that are built into Firefox, you know, text plus, text minus, and, you know, normal text size, creates a little toolbar that just puts it into the actual Chrome of the browser. Now, you know, a lot of people would say, well, that's a trivial kind of extension, but the amount of people that I've had emailing me from around the world on that extension, it's my most popular extension. I get emails from people saying, you know, thank you very much for finally enabling me to, you know, use the web in a better way, because I hate sites that have the text too small. And you feel like saying, no, you're quite thick, because, you know, that functionality is built into your browser.
Right.
But the browser isn't making it obvious. It's not exposing that functionality in a clear and simple way, where really it should be. It should be the onus is on the browser developers to make sure that their customers can make the most out of their browser. I mean, Internet Explorer has got the option to, I think in the IE7 it's now kind of more visible, but in certainly IE6, the button to actually do text resizing, there is an actual button for the, you know, the standard toolbar. The thing is, it's not enabled by default, so a user has to go through to the customize settings and actually make that button visible. Now, my reasoning would be, well, wouldn't it make more sense to have it visible in the first place? And then if you're a power user and you know how to customize your browsing experience, then you can say, I don't need that and I should remove it. And I've had a long rant back in end of August. We were at Bruce Lawson again, and he's sort of my partner in crime when it comes to these things. We were invited down at a little gathering of web developers called Geek in the Park, and I've recently put up the transcript and the audio file from that. And that was kind of an evening rant, basically. I ranted for about an hour and a half in a very much a Bill Hicks style and chain smoking away. But ranting about these kinds of things, about, you know, there is an onus on the browser developers to make sure that their tools are better suited to people. Just installing IE7 the other day on my machine, I noticed that after you've installed it, the first run kind of dialogue that comes up gives you options of setting your privacy, and do you want to, you know, have pop-up blocking and everything else. Again, I think that's a missed opportunity there. They could have had right there, they could have said, have you got, you know, are you visually impaired? Do you need text to be bigger or smaller? Do you want the capability to do that quickly? Just as a simple question in their kind of wizard that basically then just enables that particular button in the
Yeah, that's a really good point. Definitely.
So there's a lot of opportunities there, but then the browser developers aren't grasping it. So to bring it back to the original point, so yeah, users that are having problems with sites for whatever reason, or think, you know, I really wish I could, I don't know, I wish there was an easy option to linearize this page. It's not always the web content developers that, you know, need to do it. It's not always a case of, I'll complain to this website because they don't let me linearize it. It's about, you know, be vocal about it to Microsoft and to Opera and Mozilla Foundation and say, look, we really want a linearized option in your kind of dialogues, in the accessibility dialogues. There's a lot of stuff in the accessibility dialogues in the browsers that say, ignore the, say, color choices of web pages. But why not take it further and say, ignore any kind of positioning choices or any floating choices so that the page can be linearized? And there's a lot of toolbars out there, like the Firefox Web Developer Toolbar, which are aimed at developers, so they have a lot of propeller head kind of functions that help in terms of building web pages. Why isn't there like an equivalent? Well, there are a few, but we need really high level kind of toolbars also aimed at the users themselves. So if the browsers at this stage still don't offer that functionality, I'd love to see toolbars that give that kind of option very much specifically for users. So none of the web developer kind of functions in there, but purely the ones that users could benefit, like linearize this page. That's one of the options in the Firefox Web Dev Toolbar. That would be great for just your regular users. Obviously, they'd still need to install the plugin itself, the extension itself. So you've got that first hurdle, but that will be a great thing. And I think I'll stop there because I'm kind of ranting in circles.
No, that's an excellent point. Let's move on to the web accessibility book. There's maybe 10 or 12 co-authors. Which portions of the book did you write?
Right, I only joined the team very late on, really. I was kind of called in at the 11th hour for a variety of reasons, because they just needed a chapter on the retrofitting of a website. So a website that starts off as fairly inaccessible and how it was then changed to be more accessible. So my contribution to the book itself really was a single chapter, and it's kind of very much defined purely in the chapter. I didn't have much involvement with the rest of the book. At one stage when I was first asked, I didn't even know about the content in general of the rest of the book, so I kind of had to blindly kind of start writing with a direction from my editor, Chris Mills, A-Press, Friends of Ed.
Right.
He had to kind of give me a bit of guidance and say, look, you don't need to talk about this because we already covered that there. You don't need to do the long preamble about why is accessibility good, for instance. Mm-hmm. By that point, they know it. Just talk about the redesign. So mine is chapter, I think it's chapter 15.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now, actually. Retrofitting case study, redesign of a university website.
That's the one. That's the kitty.
Excellent.
So do you want to hear a bit about that one?
No, I think we'll move on, actually.
Okay.
Because we talked a bit about that book. Actually, we had an interview with Chris Heilman, who wrote a chapter on accessibility JavaScript. Yeah.
Yeah.
But we did have a couple other questions just about accessibility in general.
One question I had, I noticed in the book there's a section on accessible Flash. Mm-hmm. And do you see Flash as being truly something that can be accessible, or is it just, webmasters have to kind of patch around it?
Yeah, I have to admit that personally, just from my point of view, I don't use much Flash. I used to do a few small experiments, again on Splinter. I've got a few kind of silly kind of Flash-based kind of things and experimentations. But in my day-to-day job, I don't really do much Flash, and I still have to admit that I can't really wrap my head around the kind of Flash tool, the Flash interface of the actual authoring tool. Adobe used to have an excellent tool called Live Motion, which unfortunately just came in a little bit too late in the whole Flash kind of era. Flash was so far ahead that Macromedia Flash platform was already so far ahead that they basically Adobe pulled it after the second version because they just couldn't compete. But that environment, I found that a lot more intuitive from my point of view, because it was very similar to, I don't know if you've ever used it, I used to do a lot of video stuff, so the interface was very much along the lines of Adobe After Effects, and I found that far more intuitive than the whole keyframes kind of weird scenario that Flash, the Flash authoring tool does. But that's a complete aside. Accessibility and Flash, really. So I don't have a first-hand experience on that, but obviously whenever you mention Flash and accessibility in the same sentence, there will be a lot of hardliners that will say, people like Tommy Olsen, little shout out to Tommy, who will say, and rightly so, they will say, there is no such thing as accessible Flash, because if I don't have the plugin, it's not accessible, full stop. And for a lot of these people, that's the end of the discussion. You know, you finish there and, you know, there's just no value in taking it further. But what I would suggest is that a lot of people kind of start intermixing accessibility with, you know, they see it as synonymous purely with access for blind people on a, you know, a text-based kind of browser or something like that. But accessibility is a lot more. There's a lot more shades of grey. There's a lot more levels of accessibility. For instance, Flash can be an absolutely essential tool for conveying very complex kind of, complex workflows, for instance, or complex kind of scenarios to people with that might have learning difficulties, you know, cognitive disabilities. People are more visual rather than textual. For instance, I don't know, the functioning of a normal kind of engine in a car. To a lot of people, they'll read the kind of text-based explanation of, you know, the various kind of phases of when the fuel is injected into the cylinder, etc., and the various things that happen there. Some people might understand that. Some people are very much kind of text-based people. They can really grasp it. Other people might be completely confused, and they would benefit far more from a kind of animated diagram and or an audio version of that runs alongside, like a narrated kind of animation. So for those people, Flash is probably the best thing you can do, really. So yes, it can have problems in terms of if I'm a completely blind user and I don't have the plugin and I'm on a platform that doesn't allow me to actually install that, etc., then purely providing a Flash kind of movie isn't accessible. But we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that there are shades of disability. There's as many kind of disabilities as there are people, really. Everybody's got their own particular situation. So if you go beyond the initial hurdle of I can't use Flash, if it's a case of yes, I can use Flash, then there are a lot of advantages. Obviously, if you're providing a lot of content in your Flash, you should really start thinking about A, making the Flash itself as accessible as you can, and Adobe and Macromedia kind of have done a great job there, really, to at least set the foundations and allow for accessibility to be kind of built into movies. It might still take very skilled experts to actually do something as accessible as, I mean, there was the example a few months ago for the J.K. Rowling website, the Harry Potter kind of stuff, where that was flagged up as the flagship example of accessible Flash, and it wasn't too nasty. You know, you could use a keyboard. Apparently, I didn't have a chance to test it, but apparently it worked reasonably well with screen readers, etc. So the actual Flash platform itself is now working more and more towards allowing for knowledgeable authors to actually build accessibility in. Obviously, you still need to have experts at hand, and I think that there were quite some high-level people involved with that site who've been working in the field of accessible Flash for quite a long time. For the kind of normal kind of little developer who's got hundreds of other things to do and they just dabble with Flash, obviously it will be at this stage still very difficult to create something that's completely accessible in Flash. But at least the option is there. And obviously, once you've done your Flash as accessible as possible, you should still cater for people who can't use Flash or who've got Flash installed but would prefer the content in a slightly different way. They might have a screen reader that is not the latest version and still doesn't take advantage of all the kind of accessibility hooks in Flash, so they would benefit from still getting a more standard kind of HTML version of it. And if you're following kind of modern practices, and if you're really doing more of a, you know, build it the way it should be built, where all your data isn't actually held in the movie, but the Flash movie itself is only a container, and your actual content is held as XML or database content or whatever, then it becomes reasonably easy to do anyway. It's a case of the content is there in a kind of format neutral way somewhere in a database, say, and then you give the user the choice. Do you want to see it kind of all singing, all dancing, bells and whistles, within the Flash kind of framework, or do you want, you know, an adapted version that still pulls it exactly from the same content source as an HTML version? Yes, there will be certain things that, you know, one medium can do that the other one can't. But it's about finding the right balance. It's about, you know, providing the same content, or at least, you know, equivalent content for a variety of audiences. And yes, then you get all the benefits of, you know, indexability for search engines, etc. So, as I said, I wouldn't say, I'm certainly not in the camp of all Flash is evil, because I have been kind of vaguely involved also with discussions across the university kind of sector for, you know, virtual learning environments and providing learning modules and learning objects for people with disabilities, including, say, you know, deaf people, people with cognitive disabilities, and for those kind of audiences, just to say, oh, we're not going to use Flash because 100% blind users might have difficulty, would be, you know, doing them a disadvantage, because they could benefit very much from Flash. So it's not a cut and dry, it's not black or white, it's not either or, you know, it's not just providing HTML, otherwise nobody can use it. It's, you know, you should really start with a good foundation that is accessible, and as much as you can do in HTML and CSS and everything else. But if you then have the way of, you know, the means and the knowledge to create an accessible Flash version as well, then by all means, you know, go ahead and do it. So it's about, you know, knowing your audience and knowing, you know, what works for specific target audiences, and still trying to do the best for all of them. But the myth of you know, universal access, that you do one thing that works for everybody in every single situation, it is a bit of a myth. But using, you know, various kind of methods, doing both Flash and HTML, you can probably do, you know, get as close as you can to that particular one.
Okay, Russ, you have one more question?
Yeah. With technology getting better and better, do you see kind of the speed of technology, especially in web design, to is it going to be kind of a tool that help accessibility, such as better screen readers and browsers getting better, or will it get more difficult, such as the widespread use of Ajax?
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, yeah, screen readers, user agents in general, seem to be getting better, and I'd love to take some credit and say that's all because of the WASP ATF stuff. But, you know, it's people that are complaining and, you know, telling browsers, look, you need to do this. It's also, obviously, the browser developers and accessibility developers themselves knowing that, you know, that there are certain gaps in their products and you need to patch them. So, yeah, the products themselves are getting better, which is, you know, it's great to see. It's great to see that the latest versions of, you know, a certain screen reader might handle things like Ajax a little bit better. There's still a lot of onus on the developers to then still care about accessibility. I think there's, for instance, with the whole rise of Ajax, it's great, but it's technology that's kind of moving so far ahead without any consideration for accessibility in many angles. And the kind of very bright people that are working on, you know, the latest cutting edge stuff, often out of ignorance or out of sometimes sheer arrogance, seem to just go ahead without any regard for, you know, what about blind users, or what about users that are just purely keyboard based. A lot of these, there's a lot of attitude of, well, look, you're stifling my creativity, you're stifling technology by basically saying, we, you know, it's great that we're using Ajax, we need to make sure that there's also fallbacks for people who might have difficulty with this. So I think there's still a lot of education to be done in terms of, yes, technology, you know, technologies like Ajax are great if used for the right reasons. There's a lot of spurious uses of Ajax where you would really think, you know, that's just gimmicky kind of effects. I mean, then, well, it begs the question, what is Ajax really? Because that's an overused term anyway. As soon as you do anything that has got like a little yellow fade or something, people start talking about, oh, that's Ajax. But, you know, the real Ajax in terms of there is content that's actually changing on your page, and, you know, your entire page might change completely without a complete kind of page refresh, but it's only like sections of it are being refreshed, that can, in many situations at this point, still cause a lot of problems. Screen readers are getting better at recognizing when it's basically the triggering itself. It's the screen reader is often not notified, or rather the user of the screen reader isn't notified that, hey, something has changed on the page. You might want to refresh this page, or, you know, do you want me to reread it from the start, or do you want me to jump to the bit that's now changed? There's still a lot of problems in that area. And it's about, yes, it's kind of a shared responsibility. The tools need to be better, need to get better in terms of looking out for those kinds of things. So obviously a screen reader should flag something up, should look out for, has the page itself changed somehow since the last time I read it out? But developers also need to be aware of that. So when they're building Ajax-C type applications, they should know that at this stage, in this, you know, in the real world now, in the pragmatic kind of world, there might be people that can't use this. It would be good if you could provide a fallback at the very least, and offer maybe a switch in the preferences or whatever for your web app that says, do you want me to do the all singing, all dancing Ajax, you know, yellow fade, things pop up on the screen, etc., or do you want me to go for a more traditional kind of server response, you know, browser server backwards and forwards kind of model? If you've built your application in a sensible way, in terms of for the Ajax functionality, then presumably it wouldn't be such a major problem doing both things, doing the call that only updates that one particular bit, or having, if it's in the non-Ajax version, do a full submit that then triggers exactly the same function. So we're not talking about the whole app would need to be completely recoded. It's just about having a bit of consideration and saying there might need to be a fallback. So I think in terms of the, you know, the future of accessibility and the future of technology, I think we're currently in a state where a lot of developers have kind of jumped so far ahead in terms of, hey, we can do Ajax stuff now, and you know, let's find, in many cases it's about, I want to use this technology, let me find a use for it, rather than using the technology for a particular reason. It's about making sure that there are other bright kind of people that are kind of working, and that's happening at the moment. Bright people that are kind of trying to work out, yes, we've jumped ahead now with Ajax, how can we kind of close the gap again in terms of accessibility? There are, you know, people like James Edwards, aka Brother Cake, who's also part of the task force. You know, he is the wizard of JavaScript. He's working very heavily on that, and there's a lot of testing going on, a lot of reports are coming out in terms of can this Ajax app be made accessible, is it working on these particular screen readers. So we're currently in a phase of catching up with developers who might have gone off and done all these clever things but have no understanding of accessibility, and as I said, often you get the very arrogant initial response of, well, our apps, you know, blind people wouldn't use the web anyway, or they wouldn't use these apps anyway. Right. From what I remember, was it, what were they called? What were they called? Basecamp. 27 Signal, 37 Signal, sorry. Left 10 out. 37 Signals apparently didn't see accessibility as such an important kind of aspect. Now, I'm quoting from memory, I might be completely wrong, so if I'm offending anybody, it's building my memory. But I seem to remember that there was a whole discussion about, you know, that accessibility wasn't really on their top priority list, because their main concern was, you know, they want to do this whole kind of Ajax-y stuff and this product that, you know, works for 99% of their user base, and screw the 1% that might not be able to use it. So it's about, you know, there's a bit of arrogance there, but I think there's a lot of just not knowing. There's a lot of ignorance in terms of the fear of the unknown. I saw it recently with, and just stop me if I'm rambling too much, but I saw it recently a few months ago when there was the announcement that Target was getting sued by the National Federation of the Blind.
Right.
Surprisingly, not up until that point, I thought, you know, we're on the right track in terms of accessibility. I think, you know, a lot of developers are understanding the issues, but, you know, as soon as that broke out in the news on various kind of websites like CNET and stuff, you saw all the kind of the comments coming out, you know, all these people coming out from under the woodwork that, you know, I thought weren't even there. People that really kind of aggressively aggressive towards accessibility in terms of, look at these blind people, they're stifling our creativity. And a lot of really kind of comments that I would have thought didn't even exist anymore. Things like, you know, very misinformed things where they're saying, blind people should stay at home, and, you know, if they need to shop, they can ask their friends or relatives to help them. You know, why should Target have to be accessible? You know, can't they just shop somewhere else, etc., etc.? and even the bizarre things like, well, what's going to happen next? Why aren't they suing car manufacturers for not making cars accessible to blind people? And you know, that shows to me kind of the fundamental misunderstanding of accessibility, really, which is, it's not about blind people, or, you know, generally people with disabilities. It's not about they want to be able to do exactly the same thing that everybody else does. You know, I'm sure that there probably are a few, but I'm sure that generally blind people aren't going around saying, I really wish I could drive a bus or a car. What they are after, though, is that they want to be independent, and they want to lead a valuable life without assistance. And that's the main thing. It's all good and well saying, well, can they not just get a sighted friend over or a sighted relative? The main point is, the technology allows them to lead a life independently, and, you know, do their business online, do shopping online, etc., independently. And that's all they want. They want a certain kind of, it goes back to, you know, a certain dignity of life. It's not, you know, anything could be like, well, can they not ask a friend to, you know, why should we put a ramp up? Can they not have a friend give them a piggyback ride up the steps or something like that? You know, it's not about wanting to do exactly the same. It's about dignity of life. And when it's easily achievable, like in most cases with web accessibility, just doing a few little considerate things like, you know, providing alternative content, making sure that things work even if you just use a keyboard, can make the world of difference to people who might have difficulty, you know, getting around by themselves. In terms of, you know, if I was completely blind, or, you know, heavily visually impaired, what would I rather do? Would I want to navigate my way around, you know, get to the bus stop, get a bus and navigate a physical shop and having to ask an assistant for help? Or wouldn't it be great if I could just go online and do my business there? Again, it's about the quality of life, independence, being able to lead a valuable life independently without having to rely on other people.
Definitely.
Okay, well, that makes sense. Sorry.
Yeah, that makes lots of sense.
Often a rant there.
Well, that's all right. That's all, you know, very, very valid points, and why we're all doing this, and why the accessibility movement is valid and should be recognized by everyone. Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to stop it there, Patrick. But we want to thank you for taking the time out to speaking with us.
It was, thank you for having me.
Sure, it was a pleasure to have you. And let's see. Yeah, look for his at least one chapter of the book Web Accessibility, and go online to find out more about Patrick and his work. See, accessified.com and splintered.co.uk.
That's the one, yeah.
Great.
Excellent.
Thank you, Patrick. Take care.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
The WebAx blog and podcast is located at webaxe.blogspot.com, webaxe.blogspot.com. Email webaxe@webaxe@gmail.com, webaxe@gmail.com. To leave a voice message, call 206-203-0585. WebAx is sponsored by Check Engine USA, website tune-ups and overhauls, www.checkengineusa.com.